Welcome to Atheist Talk on KTNF AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Good morning to all of you joining us locally by radio and streaming online. Today is Sunday, November 15th, 2015. Thank you for tuning in this morning. I am your host, Dave Pacheco. Our guest today is William Shun, who as a 19-year-old Mormon missionary found himself trolling for converts door-to-door 1,000 miles from home. A seventh-generation Mormon himself, steeped since birth in the gospel according to Joseph Smith, Shun had to place his life and writing career on hold in order to fulfill his 2-year mission, and faced quite a few challenges along the way that led to the ultimate confrontation with both his spiritual and secular authorities. Now Bill has written the story of his mission, confrontation, and eventual move away from the Mormon Church in his book, The Accidental Terrorists. Mr. Shun graduated from the University of Utah in Salt Lake City with a degree in computer science and soon began finding success as a science fiction writer. His short fiction has appeared in Salon, Storyteller, Bloodstone Review, Newtown Literary, many, many other locations and multiple anthologies, and has been nominated for the Hugo Award and the Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award, and twice for the Nebula Award. Bill Shun joins us by phone today. During this live show, we'd love you to call in with your thoughts and comments. You can reach us at 952-946-6205, or you can email us at radio@mnatheists.org. Please join me today in welcoming to the show author and accidental terrorist, William Shun. Thank you so much for joining us here on Atheist Talk, Bill.
Thanks for having me, David.
All right, so this has been a very eventful week, specifically for the type of events that you cover in your book. While you have been an apostate, according to the church, for several years, you were never officially excommunicated and just hadn't gone through the motions of having yourself officially removed from the Mormon church records until this very week. Then the text from your resignation letter is found on your website, theaccidentalterrorist.com. So let's talk about this. What was it that led you to writing this letter 20 years after you really kind of started thinking about yourself as an ex-Mormon?
Well, I'd been thinking about myself as an ex-Mormon for, like you said, 20 years. There just hadn't been a really great occasion for me to resign. And last week, the Mormon Church, they didn't actually announce the policy. It was more or less leaked from their new general handbook. Their new policy was that the children of same-sex couples who were married would automatically be considered as apostates, would not be able to be baptized into the church. And that's really what galvanized me to finally take that step of having my name removed from the church rolls.
Well, and they've since clarified, I think, well, there have been several attempts to, I think, quote-unquote, clarify the these leaked new rules. What are the implications? Help us understand what the implications are for a same-sex couple who has a child in the LDS church.
Well, it's they're in a very interesting position as same-sex couples because, of course, the Mormon Church considers homosexual behavior to be a sin. They have softened their stance somewhat in recent years as to whether or not homosexuality is actually a natural behavior or something that people just engage in willfully. But with every other sort of married couple or unmarried couple, the church has always allowed their children to join the church after the age of 8. That's the age at which the Mormon Church considers them old enough to be able to make their own decisions. So this move on their part really made the children of same-sex couples the only kinds of children who were unable to make that decision on their own, unless, as I understand it, they, until they reached the age of 18 and then pretty much repudiated their parents' marriage.
And not only that, but they, if I remember correctly from reading some of the articles that have appeared this week, they have to, after the age of 18, repudiate that relationship and not be living with either of those parents full-time either.
Correct. And one of the things that just throws this policy into stark relief is the fact that, you know, you could have a parent in prison or a parent who had committed murder or something like that, and you would still be able to join the Mormon Church and be baptized. But somehow when you're the child of a same-sex couple, their sin, supposed sin, devolves upon you and makes you unable to join. So it really puts those youth in a very precarious position. And in fact, I've seen some news reports saying that calls to suicide hotlines from LGBT youth in Utah have spiked over the last week or so.
Which is truly amazing, and to an outsider especially feels incredibly thoughtless and dangerous. What are other reasons why a child between these ages of 8 and 18 can be considered unable to be baptized, unable to be part of that community?
Really, the only other reasons that you would be unable to be baptized is if you were engaging in behaviors yourself that the Mormon Church considered to be sinful. You know, if you're having sex, if you're drinking coffee or alcohol, and those sorts of things, and if you're not willing to pay tithing to the church, which is 10% of your income, in those circumstances, you wouldn't be able to be baptized. And really, maybe the only other thing that would hold you back is if you had participated in an abortion.
But those are an abortion is when you say participating, that obviously means the woman going through that procedure, but also anybody who assists or provides the procedure. But it seems that all of these things we're talking about are things that the individual would be doing.
Exactly.
This is the only one I'm hearing where it's the sins of the fathers or the sins of the mothers, so to speak, where that is the effect on the child to be able to have that child not even really participate in the events of the church at that time.
Exactly. That's what has so many people up in arms about this policy, and why you've seen mass resignation events in Salt Lake City in the last few days. The church really seems to be not heeding its own articles of faith. Back early in church history, Joseph Smith wrote down a set of 13 principles that were supposed to guide the church or explain its beliefs to outsiders. And the second one of those articles of faith says, we believe that man will be punished for his own sins and not for Adam's transgression. In one sense, that was repudiating the idea of original sin. But in another sense, it was saying that we will all be considered on our own merits and won't be punished for anything that anyone else has done. So the church policy just doesn't make a lot of sense in that regard.
It seems rather a reasonable policy to begin with, the policy of saying, you know, you will be punished for your own actions as opposed to the actions you've inherited from somebody else. But so explain to us what happens. What does it mean for a child who's between the ages of 8 and 18 and so therefore cannot participate in these events? What does it mean for their in the Mormon religion? What does it mean for their eternal soul? What does it mean for the afterlife if they are in this situation? What happens to a child who dies at the age of 15? And is in this condition, is in this place where they cannot get baptized, they cannot participate in the major events of the church. What happens to them?
That's a very interesting question. I would think what happens to them is that they've already had their chance to accept the gospel on earth. I think part of what the Mormon Church believes is that everybody needs to have the opportunity to accept or reject the Mormon gospel and then be baptized. And you won't really be held responsible for all of your sins exactly if you never heard about the gospel of Jesus Christ as restored by Joseph Smith. So let's say you've gone through your whole life and not heard the Mormon religion and died, and you might have the opportunity in the next world to hear about it, and then the Mormon Church would baptize you by proxy after you're dead, and that is sort of their idea of redeeming the dead, to give everybody a chance to hear the restored gospel.
And then you're
now,
okay.
And then you're okay. I would think that this leaves those kids theologically in a very gray area where they might have heard the gospel and embraced it and really wanted to be baptized, but then they're unable to. And if they died, they might think that that was their one chance at eternal salvation. So I can understand how if you're a child in that situation, this could be a very, very worrisome circumstance.
Well, I imagine it would be traumatic. I mean, you're facing the possibility of through no action of your own, facing
exactly.
eternal damnation, or at least, you know, not getting the rewards that you would otherwise get. This must be incredibly traumatic. But how much can a child in this situation continue to participate in church activities? Obviously, they can't be baptized. They can't go through some of the ceremonies that you talk about in your book. But are they in any way shunned from the community? Are they allowed to be present? What is their situation there?
I would imagine, and this is from the perspective of someone who hasn't really attended a Mormon church for 20 years.
Sure.
But when I was growing up, what would have happened if you weren't, if you were not baptized a member of the community, you could still go to church. You could go to Sunday school classes. You could probably, be involved in all the activities with the exception of being able to take the sacrament, which the Mormon communion every week, in which you renew your baptismal covenants by eating some bread and water. And you certainly would not be able to participate in any ceremonies in the Mormon temples, which are the special worship houses where people go to perform other ordinances, ceremonies that they believe they need in order to get into heaven.
And there's a ceremony that occurs when you're about 19, which we'll get into if we have time during the show today. But I imagine, again, we go back to this concept that it's incredibly traumatic for a child in this situation. They're surrounded by a family. They're surrounded by people who are essentially saying, you're not one of us in a complete sense. I want to talk to you about that after we come back from the break, and about how the Church of the LDS Church is similar to or different from other religions that have similar situations. So please stay with us through the break. We'll return to Atheist Talk with our guest William Shun. I'm Dave Pacheco. You're listening to AM 950 KTNF, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Welcome back to AM 950 KTNF, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. You're tuned into Atheist Talk. I'm your host, Dave Pacheco. Today's guest is William Shun, author of The Accidental Terrorist. If you'd like to speak with William, ask us a question. You can call us at 952-946-6205 or shoot us an email at radio@mnatheist.org. So very timely in the news today, this particular book and this particular memoir, and everything that's going on with the church announcing, or as Bill mentioned to us, leaking this information about the new policy on LGBTQ parents and what happens to the children of those parents within the church. Now, this is very disturbing to me because of the fact that rejection of a child because of LGBTQ issues is one of the leading causes of suicide among teenagers, and the church is having to deal with this and is facing a significant backlash. Even today, in the news right before the show today, we were listening to people talking about gathering in Utah and resigning en masse. And Bill, what's your opinion on what's going to happen? How is the church going to react to this? The church has changed its policies on a lot of things over the years based on changing morality or attitudes in the rest of the world. How do you think the church is going to react to this?
I think that you'll probably see the church digging its heels for a little while. The church does have a record of softening its stance on social and civil liberties issues like this, but it usually takes some time. And I think it usually takes some time for some members of the church leadership to change over. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see this policy continue for some time after the furor has died down, and then see some kind of softening of it later. But they're not in the habit, really, of ever coming out and saying, you know what, we made a mistake. For instance, with finally admitting people of African descent to the full membership in the church and in the priesthood in 1978. It took them really over a decade from the time the civil rights movement was in full swing until they finally had a quote-unquote revelation from God that said it was time for all mankind to be able to be admitted to the full blessings of the church. So I would not be at all surprised if this was a process that took years.
So it's going to take years, and at some point in the future we'll face another quote-unquote revelation saying, oh, actually, now we've changed our minds. This is actually all right.
Quite possible.
Yeah. But that's going to take a huge amount of time. And this isn't the first time, really, that the church has kind of enmeshed themselves in this kind of LGBTQ issue, right? Proposition 8 back in California, that was something that the Mormon Church got very, very involved in.
That's right.
And have the attitudes within the church changed since Prop 8 and all the backlash the church received at that time?
I think that the attitudes of the church have changed both within the membership and within the leadership of the church. And I don't know whether the hearts of the church leaders have actually changed or if they just have noticed the changing political winds of the time, but they were extremely instrumental. In fact, I think they were probably one of the driving forces behind Proposition 8.
They were one of the major donors in terms of organizational donors.
Yes, they were, and they did their best to conceal that fact and brought volunteers in from other states to help stump for that proposition in California. It took some investigative reporting to show the full extent of the church's involvement in that. And now you see the church within the last few years has finally admitted that, yes, there may be a genetic or natural component to homosexuality and to other sexuality issues. And they have also, just within the past month or so, one of the Mormon apostles, part of the second-level ruling body of the Mormon Church, Dallin Oaks, came out with a statement that the Mormon Church did not agree with Kim Davis, the county clerk in Kentucky, who was denying marriage licenses to same-sex couples. He said, it's the law of the land, and we need to obey the law of the land. So that really seemed to signal that the church was softening its position on LGBTQ issues, which was one thing that made the leaked page from the handbook about children of same-sex couples so shocking.
But does it really, though? I mean, the in that particular situation, my impression, at least, of that discussion was, well, we're in a place where the law of the land applies, and we may or may not like it, and we may continue to be opposed to it, but we have to obey the law of the land. And given the history of the Mormon Church, especially in the early years, you know, not being seen in opposition to the law of the land is something that probably the elders in the church and the apostles are a little bit sensitive about.
They very much are. The church has quite a history of being in direct opposition with the legal system of the United States. In fact, due to the practice of polygamy and quite a few other of their early practices, they had moved out to what was then Mexican territory in what is now the state of Utah, where the church headquarters are, of course. But very shortly became part of the United States, and a whole series of not just legal but military confrontations with the United States government followed from that, as the government tried to rein in the lawlessness of polygamy.
So there has been this concern. I see that expression of following the law in the Kim Davis case as more of a legal issue rather than a softening of the support there. But there's a lot of strains of religion where leaving that core group carries with it a lot of weight. People lose access to their friends. They lose access to their families, their communities. They're rejected from the circles they may have spent their entire lives inhabiting. So let's talk a little bit about the difficulties faced by people transitioning away from the Mormon Church. What are people in that situation, the people who are resigning even today, what do they have in common with other groups like Scientology, which have these very formal processes of rejection? And what is unique to the LDS about people who leave the fold?
I think what they have in common with people like Scientologists are, like you say, they can end up pariahs from the people that they have spent maybe their whole lives or their whole adult lives around. It can create a lot of really, really bad feelings, intense feelings within families, especially if, say, children of devout parents are leaving the church. And you really do face, especially in Utah, where a lot of these resignations are taking place, your membership in the Mormon Church is very visible in the community, and you could find yourself just without a lot of friends. Now, the good thing is that so many people are doing it right now that there's sort of a community of support. But I've heard a lot of stories from people over the years who have emailed me or who've spoken at conferences who really desperately wanted to leave the Mormon Church but were afraid of divorce, afraid of losing their families, losing access to their children, even losing business opportunities because that community is so tightly bound.
It seems a very common refrain amongst fundamentalist groups, especially where your entire life, your entire community, as you say, your job and employment and business opportunities are tied into your membership with this church, which is extremely problematic and has led, as you mentioned earlier, has led to even suicides from people who feel that they no longer have a community to live in, especially if it's one they've been living with in their entire life. We're going to take a break. We'll return with our guest, William Shun, after the break. Please stay with us. I'm Dave Pacheco, and you're listening to Atheist Talk on KTNF AM 950. Welcome back to Atheist Talk on AM 950 KTNF. I am your host, Dave Pacheco, and I am speaking with William Shun, author of The Accidental Terrorists. If you have a question or comment for William on the topic of today's show, please call us at 952-946-6205 or email to radio@minnesotaatheists.org. So, Bill, the story of the book really starts with the beginning of your mission to Calgary. And let's talk a little bit about that, because the mission is a two-year event that occurs for a lot of Mormon children when they hit around the age of 19. It's supposed to be this very controlled environment for these young missionaries. They can never truly be alone. They always have their mission partner with them at all times. Their time is very, very closely monitored, and it's filled with church activities, so they can't be distracted by anything that happens in the world. God forbid they have coffee. The way the LDS missionaries are tightly scheduled with church activities, and this limits the amount of time they can spend in any other way. Talk to us about how the church does this, what they do to control the missionaries in this two-year period.
Well, the most important thing they do, as you mentioned, is assign you a companion who is your 24-hour-a-day partner, and you're supposed to never be out of that person's sight unless you're using the bathroom.
Well, thank goodness for that.
Yeah. Your companion keeps an eye on you. You keep an eye on him. And the church wants us to be up in the morning studying the scriptures for 3 hours or so, then out knocking on doors, trying to distribute copies of the Book of Mormon, trying to interest people in taking the missionary lessons, a series of six lessons that you need to hear before you can get baptized into the church. And so you're really kept moving from dawn till dusk, and you're only supposed to write letters home to your family. You're not supposed to call them. And there's only part of one day a week set aside for your shopping, for your laundry, for letter writing, and those sorts of activities. So it's church 24 hours a day, and you're not supposed to think about anything else. You're not supposed to read newspapers, no magazines or books other than the scriptures and a few church-approved publications.
Now, in spite of these tight controls, you're not supposed to, I assume, write either, and yet you managed to complete a book during that time. Tell us about that book. I don't know, honestly, I was looking around for it, but I didn't find. What happened to that book that you actually finished writing at that time, right in the first few months of your mission?
I was actually not working on a book during my mission, but I was sort of taking mental notes for a book. As soon as I arrived in the mission field, it was such a strange environment, and the missionaries around me were so different from what I had been raised to expect from missionaries that I really wanted to write about it. I already had plans at that point to be a writer, and I also had this image in my head from growing up that missionaries were all just these really spiritual, holy men walking around, just very diligent, doing their jobs. And when I saw that really a lot of the other missionaries were, you know, kind of profane. I mean, we were teenage boys, and did everything they could to break mission rules and to get away with everything they could. We routinely, I don't know any missionary who really didn't fudge on his weekly numbers when he was reporting how many hours he'd done proselytizing during the week. So I saw all this, and I really desperately wanted.
We seem to
looks like we may have just lost his connection. Phone must have dropped out.
Okay, we'll try and get him back on the air in a couple minutes. Hello. Oh, we're back.
Sorry, I can hear you.
Sorry, Bill, we lost you there for a couple seconds. Could you go back to it? Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I really desperately wanted to write about this period in my life. I didn't actually do any writing while I was a missionary, but I was taking copious notes in my head. Really wanted one day when I was done with my mission to come back and write about that entire experience.
But there was something that you had at the time. I don't know whether it was a short story or a manuscript, but
yes.
you had presented it, you had submitted it to various magazines, including Playboy magazine, which led to a little bit of a confrontation with one of your superiors.
That's right. I was working on becoming a science fiction writer. I had studied science fiction writing at Michigan State University for a summer, and I'd written a lot of short stories, and I was actively trying to get them published. So I had the manuscripts of all these stories with me. Now, this was 1986, 1987. I would pull out my stack of manuscripts and run off a copy, probably using the photocopier at a Mormon church, and pop these things in the mail and try to sell them. And I never managed to sell any stories while I was a missionary, but I had submitted one to Playboy because they were a great market for science fiction stories at the time.
Sure.
A very high-paying market. And when the rejection letter came back, someone in the mission office saw Playboy as the return address and pulled that letter aside and gave it to the mission president, who opened it and then confronted me about not writing and not working on worldly things while I was a missionary. And I was really upset, not so much by the fact that he told me that I shouldn't be engaging in this activity, but by the simple fact that he'd opened my mail.
He'd opened your mail. I know. That struck me very strongly, too, that that's the level of control that they have over you while you're on these missions. So they'd feel free to just say, well, here's somebody getting a letter from Playboy. Let's make sure that it's not distracting him from his mission. That's how tightly the control happens. And yet, as you say, many of the missionaries, a lot of the elders that you were partnered with took this whole thing a lot less seriously than others. And I think your first partner seemed to be your more conservative one. I think Elder Fowler, I believe his name was.
Yes, that's what I called him in the book, Elder Fowler. He was fairly conservative, but you know, he also had his cuss words that he told me he needed to use. So he asked my forgiveness on the very first day for the fact that he was going to be swearing around me, and I told him that was fine. But I also it was a little disappointing to me that my first mission companion, who was supposed to help me become a very spiritual man, had a problem with swearing himself. But, later, I came to appreciate it.
Well, and that was the least of the problems with the eldest that you were partnered with. He ended up being the one that, okay, cuss words, sure. He didn't use flip as which seems to be the preferred cuss word for the rest of the Mormons on the mission. But he turned out to be probably the best one of the bunch.
He did. He was pretty faithful in a lot of ways, although he also was breaking mission rules, as he later confessed to me. He had been having a relationship with a female missionary when he'd been stationed in Calgary before he and I were companions. In fact, he was so afraid that that relationship was going to get out of hand and turn sexual, and then they might get sent home early and dishonorably from their missions, that he asked the mission president to transfer him, not telling the president why, but he just said, I would like to spend my last couple of months as a missionary somewhere outside of the city of Calgary, which is how he and I ended up partners in this prairie oil town called Brooks.
Now, you left as part of the time, and I think it was from Brooks where you did this, but you left your mission after a few months on it. You made your way actually back into the U.S. You escaped until they brought out the big guns. They caught up with you, and they put you in conversations with the elders, with your superiors in the church, and then they brought out your family, having calls with you, and eventually turning you back. Now, you were missing your fiancée, Katrina, at the time. There's a lot of this driven by loneliness, driven by being homesick. How much do you think that tentative escape was driven by cracks in your faith at the time? Was it really that loneliness and that missing your fiancée, Katrina, at the time?
I don't think I would have gone to the extreme of running away like I did if there weren't some cracks in my faith that I was desperately trying to cover them up. You know, I'd had cracks in my faith my entire life. You know, going back to early childhood when I first realized that there were religions other than Mormonism and started to think, oh my God, what happened if I had been born into a Lutheran family or something of that sort, and I wouldn't know the church was true, and I would lie in bed and just be terrified because of this chance occurrence that had landed me in a Mormon family. And I had had questions about the truth of the Book of Mormon growing up because there were a lot of things in it that didn't seem to make sense. It purports to be a history of the Native American people around the time of Christ, and a lot of things in it just didn't add up to me. But a lot of my critical faculties were spent trying to be my own apologist and to shore up my own faith. So, yeah, I was fighting a lot of faith issues that I wasn't really admitting to myself at the time.
Well, it seems to be a very common experience for people who are going through this, that they rationalize, self-rationalize a lot and really find their own excuses sometimes when the ones from the religious organization, from the church, don't make sense. How different do you think your life would be now if that young Bill Shun had actually made it, as you did, into the United States, but hadn't been stopped and made it home? What do you think would have turned out differently?
It's really hard to say what would have turned out differently. I'm sure my life would be vastly different. I probably would have ended up leaving the church many years sooner than I did. When a missionary runs away and comes home early from his mission, he faces a lot of the same issues that apostates face. You know, he can be shunned at church. He becomes less desirable to potential Mormon brides and so forth. So you really lose a lot of status in the community, and I would have lost a lot of status in my family too, and I think it probably would have driven me out of the church years sooner.
Is there a difference between boys and girls at this time? I mean, they're very young. Is there a difference between one of them is treated versus another in that situation when somebody comes back from their mission before they're supposed to? Are men treated women differently from women in those situations?
I'd have to speak to a woman who had come home early to be sure, but it was always my sense growing up that the church and the community was a little more tolerant of women who came home early from their missions, because women weren't really pushed or required to become missionaries. It was just something extra they could do if they didn't happen to be able to get married. And the church, it used to be that the church didn't allow women to go on missions until they were 21. So they were at their majority already. Although now the church has lowered the age for mission service to 18 for boys and to 19 for young women. So that dynamic has probably changed quite a bit now.
And one wonders... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the young men who came home early would be treated much more rigorously, harshly. Yes,
yeah. And to the point of potentially, you know, as you say, becoming a less desirable partner for marriage in the future. I mean, this is something that's going to affect them for the entire rest of their lives. So pretty significant change. We're going to take a break, and please stay with us. We'll return to Atheist Talk with my guest, William Shun. I'm Dave Pacheco, and you're listening to AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Thank you for tuning into Atheist Talk on AM 950 KTNF. I'm your host, Dave Pacheco. Before we turn to our guest, William Shun, we have just a few announcements. Atheist Talk is produced with funding from the Minnesota Atheists, the Humanists of Minnesota, and Farmers Insurance agent Georgia Soy, and Cucumbers Restaurant in Edina, Minnesota. Please consider visiting our sponsors, and if you do, let them know that you appreciate their support of Atheist Talk. If you would like to advertise on this program, please contact us at radio@mnatheists.org. This radio program is put together by dedicated volunteers and the generous donations of listeners. Any donation, great or small, helps keep Atheist Talk on the air and in podcast. Minnesota Atheist is a 501c3 tax-deductible organization. Listeners, if you are able to help with a donation, please consider doing so at our Radio Fund page. We couldn't do this show without you, and we deeply appreciate your support. As always, we thank member Brent Michael Davids for composing the music that we use here on Atheist Talk. Check out the Minnesota Atheist website. We've got podcasts of previous programs. You can browse articles, book reviews, and the calendar of upcoming events. We always have lots of activities going on. Check out the website and the meetup group. See what's going on near you. And another way to get involved is to sign up for the Atheist Weekly email, the AWE, the AWE. Also consider becoming a member of Minnesota Atheists. And when you sign up as a member, you're showing your support of the secular causes for which we fight. Your support helps us better serve you and other non-believers. Thanks a lot for listening. Now let's get back to William Shun. Now, so Bill, similar to the way you did this in your book, we mentioned the accidental terrorist concept at the very beginning, and then we kind of walked away from it and are building up to it at the very end. So let's talk about that. You were actually declared a terror or accused of being a terrorist. You actually went to trial. You were fined, and you actually faced prison time within Canada. Why?
Well, what happened was a couple months after I had tried to run away from my mission, I was starting to feel pretty good about being a missionary. And then I was assigned to a new companion, a temporary assignment for just a day or so. Now, when he and I got together, he told me that he had been waiting for this day for quite a while because he knew I had tried to run away from his mission, and he was miserable and wanted to run away from his. And he wanted my help getting him to the airport with all his luggage. And I was brainwashed, really, enough at this point to think that I really needed to do everything I could to keep him from leaving. Now, when I ran away from my mission, the mission president told me that I was not getting in any kind of trouble for what I had done, but my companion was, for not doing everything in his power to stop me. So this is what's going through my mind as I'm driving with this guy to the airport, trying to talk him out of leaving. Now, I was not able to talk him into leaving, so when we got to the airport and he got in line to buy his ticket, I went off to a payphone and tried to get a hold of anyone else who could help me talk him out of it, the mission president, other missionaries, and really I was mostly unsuccessful. And finally, in my last ditch effort to do everything in my power to keep him from leaving, I called his airline and, in my desperation, told him that there was a bomb in a suitcase on his flight.
Yikes.
And that I realized almost immediately that what I had done was colossally stupid. And as I walked around the airport after that, I could see people in plain clothes mobilizing, people with walkie-talkies all over the place. And eventually they did catch up with me. It wasn't too hard to put together what had happened once I started going to customs and asking about the other missionary who was trying to leave and who was on that flight.
Asking exactly about that flight too. And you had made the call with the bomb threat on the same phone number that you had been using, on the same public phone that you had been using to try and contact anybody else to help you stop him from leaving, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, that would be a bit problematic, I'm guessing.
Yes, it was. And so the actual Royal Canadian Mounted Police arrested me and charged me with public mischief. And the constable's reasoning in selecting that charge was that I explained what I was trying to do, and he kind of felt sorry for me and didn't want me to get in too much trouble. But then the Crown Prosecutor's Office in Alberta tried to get my charge bumped up to hijacking because the airplane was actually in flight at the moment I made my phone call. It was flying from Edmonton to Calgary. Public mischief turned out to be a bad enough charge. I was facing a potential 10 years in prison for that. If the hijacking charge had stuck, the maximum sentence would have been life in prison.
This was a time of heightened awareness in Canada, too, because there was this view that they had to crack down on terrorism very publicly because of the Olympics.
Exactly. The Winter Olympics were coming to Calgary in about a year. This happened in early 1987. And they did want to make an example of me. Fortunately, there was a local church leader, and I do have a few things to thank the church for. They kind of helped me find a volunteer lawyer who was a member of the local church leadership, and he was very instrumental in talking the Crown Prosecutor's Office out of the hijacking charge. I pled guilty to public mischief and was eventually sentenced to time served and a $2,000 fine,
which meant a day in prison and $2,000 of your own money, which was remarkably lenient, all things considered. Have any of those people, of any of the elders that you worked with in Canada, any of your superiors at the time, have they reached out to you at any time after, say, 1995, when you kind of officially, quote unquote, became an ex-Mormon?
None of my church superiors ever reached out to me, but I've heard from quite a few of the missionaries that I served with. I've heard from the elder who I call Finn in the book, who is the one who tried to run away. I haven't heard from him for about 15 years, but last I heard, he had gone home, left the church for a while, and then met a nice Mormon girl and rejoined the fold. And he was very disappointed to hear that I had left the church. In fact, most of the missionaries who contacted me were disappointed. Some had nasty things to say to me. Some have been actually very supportive. One elder who appears under the name Elder Vickers in the book, sort of a minor character in the book, but who was a good friend of mine, has stayed in close touch. And he's still very supportive, even though he actually teaches Mormon seminary in Oregon. We correspond quite frequently, and he has actually read The Accidental Terrorist and thought it was a really terrific book.
And you've also stayed in touch with the girl who was your fiance at the time, who I think you had proposed to at the airport on the way out to Calgary?
Yes. We ended up getting engaged at the Salt Lake Airport as I was leaving to become a missionary. We haven't been in such close touch for, say, the past 10 years or so, but we were in pretty regular contact for a while. She married someone else. I married someone else. We were happy in our separate lives. But Katrina had actually left the church maybe 2 years after I got back from my mission and was one of the people who was somewhat instrumental in talking to me about why I was still a Mormon and pointing out that the church was just making me miserable and sort of helping point me towards the door.
Well, the book is The Accidental Terrorist, The Confessions of a Reluctant Missionary. The author is William Shun. The book is available from all major online retailers, print and ebook, and also through your local independent bookstores. Thank you so much, Bill, for joining us. Thank you for tuning in to Atheist Talk. We'd love for you to join us again next Sunday. I'm proud to be on the air with the Minnesota Atheists, and I hope that you've enjoyed the show. The show depends on the generous support of our members, our sponsors, and donors. Please consider supporting the show through the donation link at mnatheist.org. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
The podcast for the show will be on our radio page later today. Have a great Sunday.